Hello and welcome to Untouched, the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. In this podcast series, we will be delving into the themes of touch, tangibility and intangibility in engagements with art on an everyday basis, on trips to galleries, in curatorial practice, in artistic creation and in academic research. We will be asking what it means to physically interact with visual culture, what we can get from non-visual engagements with art, how the pandemic has changed our approach to artistic interplay, and what happens when we encounter the intangible and the unknown. I'm Anna Price, a doctoral researcher and research centre associate here at the CVC, and today I will be talking to Kate and Martina, two other doctoral researchers here at Royal Holloway. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Untouched. I'm delighted to today welcome Martina and Kate. Thank you both so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast. First of all, can you each introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do and your research interests? Kate, do you want to start?
Yeah, so I'm a doctoral researcher at Royal Holloway. I'm coming up to my final year, so I should be finishing soon. That's the idea anyway. And my research interests centre around mid-20th century art and design from Italy, but with a specific focus on craft and how craft can be used as a theoretical lens to look again at art and design movements and sort of see them in a different light. In a nutshell.
Brilliant, thank you. And Martina?
So my name is Martina. I am a PhD student here at Royal Holloway. I have my viva in 2 weeks. And I'm also an Italian associate lecturer. So my research at the moment is focusing on programmed art, or arte programmata in Italian, which is a movement developed in the 60s in Italy. And it was characterized by like industrial aesthetics and the predominant role of technology and kinetics inside the artworks, as well as haptic stimuli, which are very important for this podcast. So this movement also has given me the chance to analyze in depth the role of the observer's engagement in contemporary art, both from a sensory and cognitive viewpoint.
Amazing, thank you. And you both recently ran two workshops together called Sensing Art. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the first one, which was for doctoral students, I believe. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about that workshop and what it involved?
So I forget now how we got onto the subject of touch. I was trying to remember, but I can't. Martina might have a better memory than me. But we decided somehow that we wanted to explore this idea of touch as it relates to various types of research in the visual arts, particularly bearing in mind that for a lot of researchers, touch is something that's missing from their research practice, often because they're nowhere near the things they're studying. Perhaps they don't even exist anymore, or there's questions of conservation and things like this, which means that it's just not it's not a possibility for most people to access the things they're working on in this way. And we were intrigued to think about whether there were ways of overcoming those obstacles, like through different sort of methods, probably other than direct touch, which we kind of realized was not going to be possible for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I think we came to the same idea because we met the same difficulties in the relationship between objects and observers, and the relationship between objects and observer in our research for our PhD, which are different but at the same time very similar for some aspects. So I really think that my favorite part in this workshop was the first activity, because we had different activities. I think that Kate will talk about the second one, but the first one was my favorite it. It was fun to organize it with Kate. It was really interesting. And like reflecting on the impossibility of being able to touch objects in the majority of museum or art gallery or exhibition, we reflected on the contribution, for example, that everyday objects could make in enhancing our understanding or an awareness, of the works that are inaccessible to us in the majority of cases. So we therefore selected several contemporary artworks that were characterized by like the most diverse materials. There were sculptures, there were installations, so very different kind of artworks, also craft objects, for example. And we tried to figure out what kind of everyday object could help us the most for our purpose. And then we literally mailed to the workshop participant like a black and white photo of one of the selected artworks, and accompanied by an object, an everyday object. So like it was very important for us to send the black and white photos, not colored photos, because participants had to rely to their eyesight as little as possible. Absolutely, this was like the main aim of our activity, and they had to focus instead on the stimuli that the common objects could communicate to the recipient. So, for example, for one very famous artwork from Ella Natsui, it was an Ella Natsui installation, which is made by aluminium and copper wire, if I am correct. We sent participant, this is very funny, very, very cheap bottle caps. So instead for, I don't remember, Edmonia Lewis, The Death of Cleopatra, we sent literally like marble coaster, if I remember correctly. So an essential and engaging part of the workshop was precisely this. So at the expectation of the various participants who knew that they were to receive something. So they receiving a sort of a kit to enjoy art. And this was really fun, no? A kit to enjoy art at home. But they didn't know what to expect. Okay, that was a surprise. So manipulating the small objects helped, the participant to read and to analyze better this artwork in a different way, like becoming aware of details or other things that they could not see just watching a photo or visiting a museum behind a barrier or like reading a catalog. Okay, it was a different kind of experiencing art. Okay, so the everyday object in this case became like a sort of valuable tool, a valuable ally, for getting to know the work of art better and developing new reflections.
I think also the Ella Natsui work you mentioned, it is actually made from bottle caps. So the original artwork is made from crushed bottle caps. So that was one of the instances where we managed to send them the exact material that it was made out of. Yeah. And it is interesting as well. I think Martina mentions two of the most interesting examples. There was the marble sculpture with the marble coaster, the bottle caps and the Ella Natsui. It's almost like a textile if people sort of want to Google it, but it's made from these bottle caps. We also sent some basket images of basketry with an actual basket that came in the post. I think those people did quite well, actually. It was quite pretty. And what else did we send? Some bark, because there was a particular artwork that showed a bronze hand grasping the trunk of a tree. But not all of these pairings worked as well as each other. I think that was quite important to say, that the marble coaster with the marble sculpture didn't necessarily stimulate people as much as the bottle caps did. So it was really interesting to see the cases in which it was super super useful as an exercise, and the times in which it just felt a little bit forced and not particularly not as stimulating for people.
That's really interesting. I was going to ask a little bit about that actually, because the objects that you had given your participants are representing a part of the piece of artwork. Was there any more discussion that came out of that, of kind of like they were only physically handling an element of it rather than the whole artwork in itself?
Yeah, so it, in some ways it's always partial and limited, the ways in which an exercise like this can be helpful. What it did do, which I think was one of the most one of the sort of richest things that came out of it, was that it spurred people to think about parts of the artwork they hadn't considered. When Martina and I were discussing the workshop initially, we talked a lot about the sort of hierarchy of senses as they're applied to visual arts research, and how unbelievably dominant sight is as a sense, whether you even realize it or not. It seems so obvious, but we always talk about in terms of sight and in terms of seeing, perhaps neglecting other sensory ways in which you interact with an object. And we spoke to Professor Hannah Thompson, who does a lot of work on sort of partially sighted and blind participants and interacting with visual arts and interpreting visual arts as well. And through that, I think we really started to interrogate whether these hierarchies were absolutely necessary in the very strict and overly sort of unbalanced way that they're usually applied. And what happened when people were interacting with these objects through touch is that they started to also think about temperature and sound and smell and all these other things got evoked in a way that I don't think we had necessarily predicted. So they could look at a picture of the Alanatsui in a much reduced scale. It's actually an enormous piece of work. It covered the entire facade of a sort of palazzo in Venice. It's very hard to even imagine that scale. But when they looked at that picture and had these bottle caps in their hands, suddenly they were saying, it must have been like moved in the wind. It must have made a sound. That, you know, all these things started to be conjured that I think just from the photograph would have been difficult to get to, at least not so quickly.
Yeah, so how does the element of kind of intangibility come into play here, and thinking about the intangibility and the inaccessibility of the object?
Yeah, it's interesting that, I mean, we talked about that quite a lot as well. The element of gatekeeping that there is around who can and cannot touch objects, often for very good reasons, but that it has a knock-on effect in how we perceive the importance and value of different artworks, and how it also affects the subject of access in, for example, the museum space, where often the people that are allowed to touch an object, or perhaps handle a specific handling object, which is intended to, much like our workshop, intended to increase access to something for partially sighted or blind visitors, or I said non-sighted visitors, that can often have a bit of a devaluing effect, or there's a sense in which the touch is standing in for sight rather than being explored in its own right and for its own specific set of qualities. And I think that was something that we wanted to talk about with our participants, and also to challenge. One of our participants that had actually been non-sighted for a period of his life, and his insights were really, really interesting on that subject. And it's hard to overcome, actually, I think, that sense in which you're not replacing sight through touch. You're not trying to be a substitute. It's a whole different experience, and it's as rich and as nuanced. And it has a lot of knock-on effects, or a lot of potential in something like the museum space for access. The idea that anyone, any visitor, can get a lot out of experiencing things in a multi-sensory way. It's not something that has to be just for visitors that are non-sighted. So there was this aspect of things that we were talking about in terms of gatekeeping and who gets to touch things and who doesn't, and how that affects value and how it affects these things like access programs. There's also the question of when something, I suppose, is actually no longer existing, when something is sort of gone and you're actually studying something that it would be impossible to even see. Mm-hmm. I think that adds a whole new element to a practice like this. But I think that needs to, perhaps be explored a bit further. What do you think, Martina?
I was reflecting on what Kate said before about intangibility in museums, because it's not an easy solution. So when you enter in a museum, you know, there are these very fake and plastic thing that you can touch, but it's a sort of it's the equivalent of a B movie, no? It's something that, okay, you can touch it, but at the same time is not equivalent as the real piece of art, you know? It's something, it's a not real proper experience, no? It's something not so valuable as touching the real piece of art. I think that it's not easy to solve this question. So how to give the possibility to have an haptic, an haptic experience with real pieces of art. But at the same thing, sometimes I think that intangibility could offer to the observer the possibility to improve their imagination, to improve their their fantasy. It could stimulate in other ways. But I think that the problem of touching for people who can see cannot be solved at the moment. We still have to reflect on curatorial, on activities, and there are many aspects that should be that should evolve inside museum. But I really think that other senses could be included in these analyses. Like, I'm a great fan of, you know, auditory stimuli and also smell. Why not? I worked in a museum full of different smells. We were preparing an exhibition about food, but I think that other sensory stimuli could help, especially to improve, for example, social relationship or cognitive perceptive reflections. Why not?
Absolutely. I think definitely the whole sensory approach and thinking about all the senses is really interesting when engaging with art and also researching art as well. Your workshop lays a really interesting path for engaging with visual culture from home in a physical way and in a sensory way. And I know you've sent kits to your participants, which I think is really cool, a little routine to engage with the art. Can you offer any advice for researchers who may be listening, who weren't participants, on how to do this at home?
Well, I should say that the second half of our workshop as well was another practical activity, which you could definitely do both of these things from home. So the second half, we encouraged people to take the object that they'd been given and make an audio description of it. Mm-hmm. So inspired actually by some of the work that an artist, Lenka Clayton, had done. I'd found she's a US-based artist, and she'd done this project a few years ago where she had worked with her local community, and particularly non-sighted or partially sighted members of that community, in a way in which she recorded an audio description of a Brancusi work, and they were involved in a making workshop alongside the audio description. So actually molding and carving, they were making in response to her audio description. So the original item was a stimulus, the visual sort of interpretation of it was a stimulus, but the bulk of the activity was in fact centered around listening and making and touching. As a way of understanding an artwork through means other than sight, or through a vicarious sort of witnessing, if you like, because she'd made this audio description. So we wanted to ask our participants to make an audio description of their object, but taking into account specifically those elements to do with other senses. So what does it sort of feel like, textures, weight, temperature, what would it sound like? And to think about placing it in different scenarios as a way of describing it. So if you dropped it, it would. If you tapped it, it would sound like this. This kind of description, rather than just describing it visually. And I think that was really helpful because it was hard. And it really hammered home how much sighted people are programmed to see the, like, there we go, I'm already using the language of it, to interpret the world, to perceive the world through that sense almost alone, or to disregard the way they perceive with other senses. And it I think it really helped us to A, realize how challenging it was, and also to start seeing, to start interacting with these objects in a different way. Mm-hmm. So if you were at home and you wanted to, for example, like exercise that muscle in some ways, I think you could choose almost anything. Perhaps better to choose something that you're not, I don't know, you could try something you're very familiar with, or you could try something that's been in the back of a cupboard for a while, and think about how you would make an audio description of it, really privileging its sensory qualities other than how it looks. Mm-hmm. So how it sounds, smells, feels in the hands,
dimensions.
Yeah. And we spoke, this is something we spoke to Hannah Thompson about before we did the workshop, because she had a lot of insight into what makes a good audio description. Mm-hmm. And the question of how much you can rely on your own frames of reference. Because some of the most evocative and helpful things can be when somebody says it's the size of a basketball, or in Lenka Clayton's workshop, I think she said she gave the dimensions of sort of 30 something centimeters, but she also said the size of a curled up cat or something. I don't remember now, but it was a personal reference. And I think those are far more, can be far more evocative for people, but if you don't share the same frames of reference, they can also be quite exclusionary. Mm-hmm. So there's this balance to find in this practice, especially if you were thinking of it in a sort of public setting. That if it's just for your own personal research as an exercise, of course you can use whatever terminology is most helpful.
I think that's really you said about the personal connection, because I wanted to ask, in addition to being able to understand more about a piece of artwork via touch, do you think that physical engagement changes a researcher's or a person's personal relationship with a particular piece of art? You know, in everyday life, post-COVID, I find that there is a connection between touch and emotional feeling. And I wonder if this can manifest in physical contact with visual culture, in research, or just in general engagement.
I think it certainly can. It's something it springs to mind as well, that sometimes a part of a practice of meditation or mindfulness can be to touch, or sort of explore things through touch as a way of like grounding yourself, as a way of sort of emotionally grounding yourself. And I think that's quite an interesting aspect of doing something like this too. But certainly it can conjure up sort of maybe perhaps memories, or make you have a sort of quietness that allows you to sort of think about things that perhaps you wouldn't necessarily if you were conducting something in a slightly more, let's say, intellectual way. Martina, did you have any thoughts on that one? It's quite a
difficult question.
Yeah.
I was reflecting on the fact that a touch it's like one of the most primitive sense that developed in human amongst humans, so that would certainly have a value in our reflections. No, I was thinking about it because it's like the first one. I remember we read a paper about it by Christopher Perricone called "The Place of touch in the arts. It was referring to touch as an essential and valuable tool because touch is one of the most primitive sense developed amongst human. Yes. Mm.
He sort of said it's the first way you learn about the world, yeah, the first method through which you explore the world. Yeah.
And I was thinking about, because I'm a great fan of vicarious touch, this idea of vicarious touch, which means see someone else touching something, you know, and react to someone, to watching someone else touching something. And I think that this could be extremely important in this kind of activities, and doing this online was a problem because it was difficult to perceive this kind of relationship amongst the participants. That was something that we wanted to see also, but it was difficult and impossible because of the distance. But this is extremely important. Kate mentioned before vicarious touch. I think this is incredibly powerful. How you react in front of someone else who is touching something. So it gives you an idea of what he's touching. He communicates something. So in this way, we have another definition of the piece of art, the definition that I have, watching you touching the object. So we can expand the experience and the artistic experience in a broader way. I think that this is something that should also be, you know, analyzed. I really think that we should organize something new, Kate, maybe in person, and how to say, deepen our analysis of the role of touch.
I definitely think that there's a link as well, just sprung to mind, with the kind of ASMR. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of ASMR. I am a feeler of the tingles. People listening to this won't know what that means. They're going to think that's very strange. But that is very much what Martina's describing, is the sensations that you can get through watching somebody else's experience. Of touch, which often involves sort of sounds as well, which can be intensely relaxing and calming. And that's an area of burgeoning scientific research as well, that is actually, you know, still quite little understood as a phenomena. And is often, and is usually done through video or sort of online. I think people don't go to live ASMR. They listen to it or watch sort of YouTube videos. Stands for autosensory meridian response, I think. So I think that would be a really interesting way of opening it up to another connection with something that's sort of going on now that's not in the sort of research or academic or even arts and culture world, but certainly the V&A, in fact, had, I don't know if it's still going, their conservation department had an ASMR channel. There's a link. It's really good. It would be an often sort of textile work, you know, when they're sort of washing or wrapping things. It's incredibly calming to watch, and you do get that sense of vicarious touch in a museum setting. So those gatekeepers, those few people, curators and conservators, that get to touch these items, it's a way of opening up those doors and sort of sharing some of that with other people. I don't know if that's what they intended it to be so much as jumping onto this kind of growing trend or notoriety associated with ASMR, but I think it's a good thing. You don't know where it could go in lots of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting to think about a bodily reaction as well, like a really physical reaction to hearing those interactions. That's really interesting. I'm going to move on a little bit because I'm conscious of the time. Has sensing art, has your workshops changed the way that you approach your own research? And if so, how?
Yeah, so my research looks at both objects of art and design and thinks about them through craft. And one of the many different aspects of craft has to do with making and tactility and materiality. And it certainly has helped me to reflect more deeply on those sort of multi-sensory aspects of the things that I'm looking at. In fact, one of the works that I'm doing a case study of is actually in the Tate. So I am able to go and look at it and even stand quite close to it. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about this work is that its original iteration in like 1966, it was an interactive art piece. So when it was shown then, at least on one of the occasions, people could interact with it, they could move it, they could touch it, they could even go inside it. It's this sort of big basket, it's sort of man-sized cone basket. So they would have been able to touch it. And ever since it's been in a museum collection, for very obvious reasons and good ones, it has not been able to be interacted with in this way. So it started off life as a touchable artwork. Now it's not. And I'm visiting it in the museum, having done our workshop or thinking about the ways in which we might develop our workshop. And it does make me think of it in a new light. And suddenly I can sort of hear it creaking. And if you moved it, and wondering sort of what it sort of smells like, and thinking more about the way it was made. And I think that's something that is lost from a lot of artworks, especially those that perhaps don't have an obvious technique of making. It's not sort of, this particular work I'm speaking about is woven, so it's quite clear. But as soon as you start to touch something and explore it in a tactile way, you do start to think a little bit more about how it was made. And I think that's something that has sort of come into the way I'm looking at the artworks I'm studying now. I know Martina's work is also very interactive, so it was work that was meant to be touched often.
More or less the same reason. So I really want to pursue this idea of art as a communicative, that has to be communicative, and this idea of art as a multi-sensory experiences. So the pieces of art I'm studying are, in the majority of cases, little engines, very little electric motors that has to be activated in front of the observer. And that in the majority of cases, especially in the first part of the activities of these groups of artists in the 60s, this object could be touched by people. So the fact is, nowadays, if you want to see these objects in museums, these objects are behind a glass and they cannot be touched anymore. So from my point of view, these are not anymore pieces of art. Mm-hmm. So their role as artistic objects failed to exist now, because if you cannot touch them, there is no experience. If there is no experience, there is no piece of art. I would like to pursue my studies in this sense, and this workshop helped me a lot, because I want to improve my knowledge about people in front of an object, people interacting with an object, the relationship between people interacting with an object. So this kind of reflection about the engagement of people with contemporary art is something that really interested me. And sometimes it's difficult to study this kind of stuff, because especially for exhibition happened in the 60s, it's difficult to understand how people reacted to a particular provocation, to a particular experience. So this workshop gave me also a theoretical background. I learned about vicarious touch and whatever. So I think that it helped me a lot, and it will continue to inspire me for future experiences.
A point about sharing an experience of art, yeah, I think is a really good one as well, that is perhaps more easily accessed through sort of touching and interacting with something more physically than it is from just looking at something. Yeah. You can sort of share it with others in a different way. Yeah.
People is a social animal, so we should study this more.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a few quick fire questions to end off with, which we're going to ask each of our podcast guests. First one is, what is your favorite piece of visual culture that you have been researching?
I guess one of my favorites probably is the one I mentioned just now. It embodies just lots of the different things that I've been looking into. I'd recommend everyone go and see it. It's in the Tate at the moment in there. The display is something like materials and making or something. It's a big willow cone by Mario Merz, who's an Italian artist. And yeah, it's very cool.
I'll be linking all of the artworks that you've said in the episode.
Okay.
People can find them. Martina, what about you?
I think, but I'm not sure about it, that is elastic space, which was made in 1968 by Gianni Colombo, another Italian artist, programmed artist. He won the Venice Biennale with this artwork in 1968, and it's a proper environment. So it's a very, very dark room where there are these cords placed like from floor to the ceiling. It's a sort of grid, and these cords are lit with UV light, so the environment is very dark, but there are these sort of cords throughout the environment, so it's an immersive environment, but people is always like confused when he's inside this environment. So it's very stimulating for the senses, but at the same time people getting lost inside of it. So it's how to say, yes, it's an environment.
Amazing. And do you have a favorite piece of visual culture outside of your research? So something that you've not been researching, but that you absolutely love?
It's really hard to think of a favorite. Martina, what do you think? Maybe I'll come up with something.
Yeah, so always said that people who love very contemporary art also love very ancient art. So this is my case, and if I have to find like my favorite piece of visual culture in the world, I would say something from archaeology, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like a piece of stone carved by a Sumerian, something that can reflect the origins of art, the origins of communication. Since I'm very keen in this topic about art as a communicative element, like a semiotic stream of information, I think that a Sumerian tablets carved, it's my favorite piece of art.
Amazing. Thank you.
It's really hard to choose a favorite. I feel like it just says a lot about you, and I'm just not prepared to make that claim. No, that's
it's a commitment to choose.
Like favorite. Having a tattoo. Yeah.
And finally, is there anything that you'd like to promote or make our listeners aware of with regards to any upcoming projects or research?
I would say we might like to plan future workshop or something on the same sort of subject and expand it a little bit, maybe do something in person.
Yeah, me too. I would really love to work in person with Kate on like in a museum or in an exhibition site.
Yeah, that would be nice. Do something in collaboration.
Yeah,
it's a watch this space scenario.
Yeah. once Martina's done her viva, maybe we'll have time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, best of luck to the both of you in the finishing of your degrees, Martina with your viva and Kate with your last year. Thank you both so much for chatting to me about this and for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Untouched. All the information you need to find out more about us at the Centre for Visual Cultures is linked in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions on what we've discussed today, email us at centreforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk or tweet us at @rhul_CBC. This podcast is produced by the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures, located in the Languages, Literatures and Cultures Department at Royal Holloway. Edited and hosted by myself, Anna, with music by Gaspar Senna. See you next time.